It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegebray. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
That's one of the easiest things to fix. I always tell places, you can make an accessible parking spot with some blue paint and a sign you can get at Home Depot. The other thing we find are ramps. You know, there are curbs, and you know, it actually takes less concrete to make a curb cut than it does to make a curb. When places say, I can't put it in, I say, give me a couple of 2x4s, some cement, and a trowel, and I'll make you a ramp. The Department of Justice estimates that most fixes cost less than $500.
Jonathan Martinez, managing attorney at the Virginia Office for Protection and Advocacy, describes the laws that protect people with disabilities against discrimination in public accommodations and public access. And during this week's question and answer session, we'll tell you about the three opportunities under Virginia law to pay your rent late and stay. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 77, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR, 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. In mid-January, the Richmond Redevelopment and Housing Authority, or RRHA, sent all 4,000 of their tenants new leases to be signed no later than January 22, and threatening lease termination for failure to sign the new lease. However, federal regulations require RRHA to send written notice of changes to every tenant with a 30-day period for comment before implementing the new lease, and RRHA failed to do so. On behalf of the Richmond Tenants Organization, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society told RRH's attorney that it would file a lawsuit seeking an emergency injunction if RRHA would not stop its plan to require such signatures on January 22. RRHA backed down a day before the deadline, saying they would not go forward with the new leases. However, by then, many tenants already had signed the new lease, and in some cases, were only given the signature page to sign. RRHA has promised to write all tenants who have signed the new lease and advise them the old lease still is in effect. Any RRHA tenant who signed the new lease on or before January 22 may regard that lease as void and of no effect. In other news, the Virginia Main Street Alliance released a new report highlighting impacts of the financial crisis on small businesses and their views on financial reform. The report, Main Street Policy Pulse, Small Business Views on Financial Reform, is based on a survey of more than 1,200 small business owners from 14 states and finds strong support among small businesses for strong financial reforms, including the creation of a Consumer Financial Protection Agency. Key survey findings for Virginia respondents include 76% don't believe enough steps have been taken to shield small businesses from another Wall Street collapse, 70% support passage of strong financial reforms, and 82% support creation of a Consumer Financial Protection Agency. Small businesses, key to job creation strategies and economic recovery, could prove a pivotal voice in an unfolding debate in which big business lobbies have sided with the country's biggest banks in opposing financial reforms, even as small businesses continue to pay the price, in lost business and frozen credit for the speculative wave on Wall Street that caused the financial crisis. The report is available at www.mainstreetalliance.org/publications. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's legal term of the week is non-service-connected VA disability. Non-service-connected VA disability is a benefit paid to wartime veterans with limited income who no longer are able to work because of a disability not connected to their military service. Eligible veterans must have been discharged from service under other than dishonorable conditions, have served at least 90 days of active duty, have disabilities that keep them from working a regular full-time job, and have countable income below a yearly limit. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault. And non-service-connected VA disability is this week's legal term of the week.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. It's time for this week's question and answer, and we're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
David, from Henrico County.
Thank you, David. Welcome to the show. What question do we have this week?
Yes, I am 1 month late on my rent. And as far as evictions, I'm just wondering what the Henrico County laws are as far as how soon they can evict me and what I need to do to prevent it if it goes 2 months.
Okay. Well, the Henrico County laws are the same as the rest of Virginia. Basically, Virginia law gives you 3 opportunities to pay your rent late and stay. The first would be within any grace period of your lease, whether that's 5 days or 10 days or whatever. And if you pay within the grace period, you get to stay. You can do that any number of times. If you don't pay within the grace period, then your landlord has to give you a written 5-day pay or quit period. And that usually asks for the rent and the late fees. And if you pay the rent and the late fees within that 5-day pay or quit period, then you get to stay. And you can do that any number of times. Now, if you don't pay within the 5-day pay or quit period, then your landlord can file a summons for unlawful detainer, an eviction case in court. And that gives you your third and final opportunity to pay late and stay. But you have to pay everything you owe, the rent, any late fees called for in a written lease, any attorney's fees called for in a written lease, and the court costs, and you have to do that no later than the first court date. If you pay it on or before the first court date to either the landlord, the landlord's attorney, or to the court has no choice but to order the case dismissed as paid. And even if you pay in advance to the landlord or the landlord's attorney, I always stress that you have to go to court, go into the courtroom, be standing in front of the judge or the clerk, and be sure you hear someone with the court say, this case is dismissed, paid. Because often landlords or their attorneys just make mistakes, they take people's money, and they go ahead and they get a judgment of possession anyway. And that's a mistake, and it can be corrected, but it takes a lot of time to correct it. Have you received any type of a written 5-day pay or quit notice yet?
No, I have not.
Well, then you're in good shape because the landlord has not even taken the first step in order to seek your eviction. So definitely you should be trying to work with your landlord, let him know what your plans are to pay the rent, try to make partial payments if you can, let the landlord know that you're not ignoring the obligation and that you do intend to honor it. But at this point in time, without the landlord having given you a written 5-day pay or quit notice, the landlord has no legal right to file a summons for unlawful detainer. And if the landlord does, then you need to get legal help right away. And that's one of the things we do quite a lot of. Is that helpful to you?
Yes, that answered all my questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being on the show. You are listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the Virginia Office for Protection and Advocacy, and we're speaking with Jonathan Martinez, who is a managing attorney, and we'll be speaking with him about the rights of people with disabilities in public accommodations. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Good morning.
Tell us, who is protected by the laws dealing with the rights of the disabled to public accommodations?
People with disabilities. People with disabilities are defined by the Americans with Disabilities Act. Broadly speaking, a person with a disability is somebody who has a condition, physical or mental, that substantially affects one or more major life functions. Those are things like walking, thinking, talking, breathing, in some cases working. They also covered people who have a history of a disability, people who had cancer but are in remission or with heart conditions, or people who are considered to have disabilities even if they don't.
Okay, now we're talking about public accommodations, and that I'm sure has a very broad definition. Under this law, what is considered a public accommodation?
Some place the public can go to, essentially, or that affects commerce. The law gives about 18 very broad examples, like places of lodging, like hotels, places of recreation, like gymnasiums or movie theaters. Essentially, if the public can go there and they're invited there, it's covered by the law. One major exception is housing, which is covered by the Fair Housing Act, that is by and large not covered by the ADA.
So if you can get there, then it is covered by these laws.
Yes.
So that covers pretty much any place of business, any place that sells goods and services. What do those places have to do in order to comply with this law?
One of the reasons why I love the ADA is it actually says what businesses have to do. Lots of civil rights laws say don't discriminate, but don't tell you how to do it. The ADA comes out and says what you have to do. And in Title III, which we're talking about, they require places to be accessible in two ways. If you have been built or renovated after 1992, you are required to meet all of the definitions of accessibility set forth in the law. It's called ADAG, or the Americans with Disabilities Act Accessibility Guidelines. One of the reasons why the ADA is great is I can tell you, you're looking at a door just over my shoulder. Under the ADA, if that door is not at least 32 inches wide, it's not accessible. The ADA tells us what accessibility is. So if you are a new construction, built or renovated after 92, you must meet all of those requirements. And there's parking requirements and ramping requirements. If you were not built or renovated before that time, you must meet all of those requirements to the maximum extent possible. The law says readily achievable. So there is no, for example, grandfather clause in the ADA. Places will say, oh, I'm grandfathered from the ADA. When I hear that, I laugh. I say, show me where that clause is in the law, because it's just not there.
So these construction requirements, how often do you find them to be violated by places that were built after the effective date in 1992?
Lots. I don't think it's malice. I think places just don't know. I think sometimes the builder didn't pay attention. But we see things like parking spaces that are very far away from the door when the law says it should be the nearest space. We see things like ramps that are too steep. It does happen. I will say in the vast majority of cases we've had, when called to their attention, businesses have fixed it.
And in terms of the places that were built before 1992, again, how difficult is it to get places to comply with the law, what they're supposed to do?
A couple of answers to that question. Before they know that they're in violation, very hard. I would say the majority, if not the vast majority, of older construction is not in compliance with the ADA. However, I'm trying to think of any case we've had involving old construction where we didn't eventually get a fix or a settlement or something like that. As I said, it's not malice. It's lack of knowledge. And in general, when we have called it to their attention, and sometimes we've had to go to litigation to do that, we have gotten places to fix themselves and become accessible.
One of the cases I know that's been in the news quite a bit has been the case that was actually brought by the Virginia Office for Protection and Advocacy against the Virginia Lottery, because the allegation there was that the convenience stores selling lottery tickets were not accessible, did not meet the rules. Could you tell us about that case as an example of the type of thing that the law covers?
Yes, that case is ongoing. It does not fall under the public accommodation section of the ADA. It's actually under the government section, because our theory has been from the beginning that it's the lottery's responsibility to make sure that its retailers are accessible. So if the lottery is selling tickets and they are going to pay a convenience store a nickel a ticket to sell them, our position is that the lottery has to ensure that those convenience stores are themselves accessible. That case went to the Supreme Court of Virginia, and the Supreme Court did hold that the lottery is responsible for ensuring that people can buy their tickets. They have not come out and said exactly how that accessibility is to be attained. It remains our position that the lottery has to do that. But looking just at the convenience stores, you're right. Way back 10 years ago or so, the lottery did their own survey of their own retailers. And the data that they came up with that we've gotten through this litigation said that about 94% of these retailers are not accessible, not compliant with the ADA. And that's what I mean about the vast majority of places that were built before 1994, because lots of these are older construction, not being accessible. So our goal in that case is to make the lottery make sure that its tickets are available to every Virginian, disabled or not.
So is part of the theory here that to go after this problem convenience store by convenience store would be far less efficient than trying to do it more systemically and say, hey, there's a government function going on inside that convenience store. It's a state lottery ticket being sold. They're being paid by the state to do this. Therefore, let's make it a more systemic attack to the problem.
That's exactly what I told the Supreme Court. I said we could, because the lottery's position was, why not go after the retailers themselves? And my answer to that is this. There's over 5,000 retailers. Let's say we filed 5,000 lawsuits against 5,000 retailers and we won every single one of them. It's going to take years to win those cases. And during that time, the lottery is still going to be giving licenses to inaccessible retailers. So the problem would be worse after we won those cases than it was when we started it. The logical place for this enforcement is with the government entity that is having the program. The lottery should make sure that the lottery is accessible.
What do you find are the major problems that people with disabilities face in public accommodations? Obviously, we've talked about convenience stores. A great number of them, you said, were built before 1992, and therefore they were not newly built to be accessible by these standards. What are the other major accessibility problems that are brought to your attention?
The worst problems that we see time and again are the easiest ones to fix. And for people with disabilities, the most important issue, and that's this: parking and getting in the door. And once you get in the door to a place, odds are you can become a customer there. But places don't have parking, accessible parking. And then there's, again, I told you how great the ADA is about defining what's accessible. There are very specific requirements for what makes an accessible parking space. That's because if a person is driving, let's say, a van, an equipped van, it needs a wider space. And it needs an access aisle next to it to make sure you can get out of your car without getting hit. So there's very specific requirements for what makes a parking space. Well, what we find is that even if places have something they're calling the accessible parking space, it's often the farthest away from the door. It's not wide enough. There isn't any kind of sign telling other people don't park here. That's one of the easiest things to fix. I always tell places, you can make an accessible parking spot with some blue paint and a sign you can get at Home Depot. The other thing we find are ramps. You know, there are curbs, and you know, it actually takes less concrete to make a curb cut than it does to make a curb. When places say, I can't put it in, I say, give me a couple of 2x4s, some cement, and a trowel, and I'll make you a ramp. The Department of Justice estimates that most fixes cost less than $500. And I would concur. That's the problems that we see. I can't park at your place. I can't even get to your door, let alone get in the door. And consistently, those are the most obvious problems. There are others. In stores, aisle width. But you can imagine that can be fixed by making your aisles wider.
Sure. And so it sounds like so many of these fixes are cheap and simple, and yet the problem persists. Why do you think the problem persists, given that the solution is so often cheap and simple?
Lack of knowledge. I don't think I prefer to think that people aren't saying, I don't want people with disabilities as my customers. You know, I tell businesses, roughly 40 million people in this country have a disability of some kind or another. That's about 1/6 of the population. Wouldn't you want to increase your customer base by a sixth? And places, you know, when they realize it's not terribly expensive or difficult, they tend to do it. I find very few people that say, I don't want their kind here. So I think it's lack of knowledge.
And if someone is a person with a disability and they believe they are facing some problem with public accommodation, public access, what should they do?
They can call us. I mean, I can't guarantee we'll take every case, but I will say that we try to give everybody something, whether it be information, whether it be advocacy, whether it be legal representation. We've been all over the gamut of what we can do. But you can call us, and our number is 800-552-3962. If you're in Richmond, and I think this only goes to Richmond, call us at 225-2042, area code 804. We can either give you information that will help you, or maybe we can help you ourselves. The Department of Justice is also an option. That's usdoj.gov.
Thank you very much. We have been speaking with Jonathan Martinez, who is a managing attorney at the Virginia Office for Protection and Advocacy, about the rights of people with disabilities to public accommodations. Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's top three tips are about discrimination. The first tip is that discrimination means you are treated unfairly or wrongfully because of some protected characteristic or feature. For example, race, religion, national origin, age, sex, pregnancy, sexual harassment, handicap, or disability. The second tip is that not all unfair treatment gives rise to a legal claim of discrimination. A legal claim of discrimination in employment, housing, or public accommodation must be based on a protected factor. The third tip is that a charge of discrimination filed with a government agency, such as the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, must be filed within a certain time period. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King. And for this week, that's our top three tips about discrimination.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. You can get free legal information at the statewide legal aid website. This is www.valegalaid.org. You also may get free pre-recorded legal information by phone during non-business hours. These are before 9 a.m., after 5 p.m., and on weekends and legal holidays. Call toll-free 1-866-534-5243. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Harassed by debt collectors? You're not alone. But what if there were a federal law that allowed you to turn the tables on them? Join us next week when private attorney Dale Pittman explores the powerful remedies available to beleaguered debtors under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on November 19, 2008. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.